Hello, my name is Kennedy Sam, and welcome to this week's edition of Conversations with Creative Waco. We are a fourth and fifth Friday feature on KWVU. We have two guests joining us this episode. First, we are chatting with Emily McDonald from the Historic Waco Foundation about their upcoming exhibition, Making History, Art of Historic Waco, which opens December 5th. In the second half of the episode, Melissa Pardon will be joining me. Melissa is co-owner of Maker's Edge Makerspace and will be sharing a few updates. Later on, stay tuned for David and Art with David Smith. To kick off the show, we welcome Emily McDonald. She serves as the Director of Marketing and Volunteer Coordinator for the Historic Waco Foundation. Hey, Emily, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Yeah, so can you give us a brief introduction to the Historic Waco Foundation and why it was founded?
Yeah, so Historic Waco Foundation was founded in 1967 through a merger of three common interest groups, the Heritage Society, the Society for Historic Preservation, and the Duncan Foundation. Today we operate three historic houses, and we like to use them as an opportunity to preserve Waco's heritage and history while also educating the public about the importance of history and inspiring our community.
Can you tell us a little bit about each house and why they're located? I guess a little bit about the families, too.
Yeah, so one of the first houses is the Earl Napier Kennard House. It's located on 4th Street, just right off the interstate. Unfortunately, due to construction right now, it is closed to the public. But this house is really interesting. It's right across from, you know, where all those restaurants are, yeah. In and out and whatever. And it was owned by the Earl family. And it was really interesting because at the time, it was owned by a wife and her husband, and her family lived right across the street. So there was actually a house directly connected to the house just right across the, 4th Street. And that house is actually the Earl Harrison House, mm-hmm. which is now located by Cameron Park. So many families lived in that house, obviously the Earls, the Napierds, and the Kennards. And the house right now is currently interpreted from about 1858 to 1869, so we have some really interesting pieces in there. The house is beautiful, two-story Greek Revival structure, and a lot of the furniture pieces inside are actually original to the home, which is really interesting. One of our next houses, kind of we call it the crown jewel, is mm-hmm. East Terrace House. It's located more towards Cameron Park on 100 Mill Street. This house was built by John Wesley Mann in 1874. The house is constructed of bricks that were all made from the Brazos River.
Oh.
And what's really cool about that is these bricks and this brick company was also the company that provided the bricks for the suspension bridge. So if you drive by East Terrace, you'll notice there's kind of like almost like a watchtower type thing coming out the top. And so it's really fun. John Wesley Mann, the owner of the house, used to sit up there and watch them build the suspension bridge from that little watchtower. And he could kind of make sure everyone was keeping on track.
Especially now that it's under like construction
and
stuff.
And you can't really see it at this point anymore because of the other bridges that have been added. But it was really interesting at the time. And East Terrace, it is interpreted as it was when the Manns lived there. But there's another really interesting history to the house. In the 1900s, it was a chiropractic and psychiatric sanitarium owned by Charles Lemley. So we don't interpret that part of the story as much, just because there's not a lot of history about it. But that is kind of the history of the house and how it came to be. And so it's really beautiful. And that is where Making History will be, which we'll talk a little bit about more later. And then finally, we have the McCullough House, which is located downtown on Columbus Avenue. This house was originally started out as just a two-room cabin. It was purchased by Dr. Josiah Caldwell in 1866. And then in 1870, it was sold to the McCullough family, and they added on to much of what you see today. The McCullough family, like the Manns and the Kennards, they're kind of a well-known family mm-hmm. in Waco. He served as the mayor. So, you know, most of these houses were big, kind of grand for the time. Not really the house of the everyman in Waco, but kind of more of the high society individuals. And this house is currently open on Saturdays and Sundays. So we're super excited about that.
Yeah. So each house is kind of like its own museum bubble mm-hmm. within, you know, its space. So what are the benefits of using the houses as that kind of individual museum for their own items instead of using just like, you know, one giant space that would just tell the history of those spaces?
Yeah. It's really interesting when you think about that because, you know, Waco has a very storied history. Mm-hmm. But what's great about having three individual spaces is you can really tell three different stories that all relate to the greater story of Waco's history. Mm-hmm. And due to their locations, like the McCullough House, for instance, downtown was very close to what used to be called the quote-unquote reservation. Mm-hmm. Waco was a red light district. And so that house was very close to that. So when you're at the McCullough house, you're able to tell that story as it relates to Champ McCullough and Dr. Caldwell that lived there and their influence they had on that part of Waco's history. Whereas East Terrace was built to be kind of farther away and, you know, and then its story as a sanitarium. It was really cool as a sanitarium because it was so far out of the city at the time. Right. So you can kind of tell almost three completely different stories that relate to the broader picture of Waco's history.
Yeah. And as you mentioned earlier, the Historic Waco Foundation is kind of like a culmination of three parties. Mm-hmm. When did it become the Historic Waco Foundation?
The three foundations merged in 1967.
Okay. And so within each house, they have their own history. What historical time or story is told within each house? Like, I know you mentioned earlier, I think the 1880s or so?
Yeah. So each house is a slightly different period as well, which mm-hmm. is another great reason to have them all stand on their own. But they all interpret about the mid-1800s. So from about 1866 to the latest we interpret is about 1884.
Yeah. And so within those houses, you have, you know, original items and other mm-hmm. historic collections. What's the process of, like, picking and choosing which items belong in which house?
Yeah. A lot of times we try to keep the pieces that belonged in those houses in those same houses as well. So in the Earl Napier Kennard house, we have one of the original beds that belonged to the Kennard family, and that's in the bedroom. So mm-hmm. we try to keep it as in line with the family as possible. And then obviously we do have a pretty large collection of furniture, so we kind of fill in as needed mm-hmm. to make the house look nice and tell, you know, a broader story. In East Terrace, after it was used as a sanitarium, we went through the process. I didn't, but in 1976, right. they went through the process of, you know, kind of reinterpreting it as a house from the 1800s. And so the kitchen obviously was a big part of that. And so most of those pieces were donated by generous donors or purchased at auction and then just kind of filled into whatever house as needed.
Yeah. So how do the guests interact with the tours and things at each house?
Mm-hmm. So we have a great team of docents, some paid staff and a lot of volunteers as well that donate their time. And guests can expect a tour of each home with a docent. Usually they last between 45 minutes and an hour. And we try to make those experiences with guests as engaging as possible. We encourage them to ask questions and tell us what they're interested in so we can tailor the tour towards them. But overall, you know, we'll take them through the house, tell them small anecdotes, you know, and every tour is so different because we really mm-hmm. encourage docents to kind of let their personality shine through their tour.
Yeah. So I know you mentioned one of the houses are closed right now due to construction, but are the other houses open for, you know, as normal business?
Yeah. So East Terrace is currently open Tuesday through Sunday, and then the McCullough House is open Saturdays and Sundays.
Yeah. So outside of the house tours, you guys also host exhibitions and partner with organizations to host some of your programmings. Mm-hmm. You know, more recently you guys had Fall Art on the Terrace. So why do you guys incorporate that kind of into the function of the Historic Waco Foundation?
Yeah, obviously, like I mentioned at the beginning, community engagement and education is really important to us, and so we try to provide opportunities for families and young children to get involved with the Historic Waco Foundation, even if, you know, a tour of a historic house might not be the most interesting to them. We mm-hmm. want to provide things that, you know, engage all audiences. And so Family Fun Days are something we try to do regularly. We try to have one once a month. So Fall Art on the Terrace with the Art Center was a great opportunity to get some new people out to the house. I think it does encourage people who haven't been to the homes before mm-hmm. to stop by. And then what's great is during those fun days, we also offer free tours of the home. So anyone that comes out just for the activities can go through the house. And, you know, it's great to see people come through that wouldn't have normally come. And, you know, their eyes light up and they start asking questions. So it's really great.
Yeah, I was scrolling through you guys' social media preparing for this interview, and I saw that you guys had an exhibition on, like, glass or something.
Yeah.
So how did that come up?
So Carnival Glass is really interesting. I don't know a lot about the history of Carnival Glass. Mm-hmm. That exhibition was put together before I came to the foundation. But usually we try to plan our exhibitions around what we have excess of in the collection. So we had a lot of Carnival Glass that hadn't been displayed before, and so we wanted to use an opportunity like a special exhibition to bring that to the public. And so that's how we usually try to plan our exhibitions. We currently have a virtual exhibit on our website that's all about the history of the kitchen. And that was done while the houses were still closed.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, since people couldn't come and see, we wanted to give them the opportunity to experience the house online.
So the upcoming exhibition, Making History, the Art of Historic Waco, opens December 5th at East Terrace. Can you share a little bit about the inspiration behind, you know, why you guys picked that exhibition?
We had a local artist, Melanie Stokes, reach out to us, interested in doing some plein air painting at one of our historic homes. And we were so excited and, you know, so kind of inspired by what she created and her vision of the house that we wanted to reach out to all local artists and encourage them to either create something or, you know, dig through their collection of what they've already created and give them a chance to exhibit it. So we're encouraging all artists, whether they're professionals or amateurs, to experience the rich history that Waco has, not just through Historic Waco Foundation, but all of the amazing, you know, historic sites in Waco, and just create something special. And that'll be on exhibition at East Terrace. We mm-hmm. have some really great spaces. That is a beautiful place to not only, you know, interpret history, but also display art. So we're really excited to have those on display through the month of December.
Yeah. What kind of artworks are you guys sourcing for that?
We're encouraging two-dimensional art at this point. So we've had some people reach out about metal etching, wood burning, and then a lot of, you know, canvas painting and collages and things like that.
What's going to be the setup for this event? How are the artworks going to be displayed within the house?
So the artworks are going to be displayed in the house through some temporary paneling, graciously donated by Creative Waco, as well as on easels throughout the first and second floor. So we're really excited about that. And then the Art Center of Waco has graciously offered the use of their Art Expedition mobile gallery for any overflow pieces that aren't able to fit in the home. So you'll be able to see some pieces in the Art Expedition as well.
Yeah, so this opens on December 5th. Is there going to be kind of an opening ceremony or anything going on?
Yeah, there will be an opening event on December 5th. More information to come about that on mm-hmm. our website, historicwaco.org. But it'll be kind of similar to a fun day, kind of just a, you know, a community event.
Yeah. So while it's open through the 15th, how can people, or what days can people stop by and see?
So the exhibit will be open during our regular operating hours at East Terrace. So that's Tuesday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. and Sundays from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. And the exhibit will be free with the cost of admission. So that's just $5 for adults and $4 for students and seniors.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Emily, for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
The exhibition, Making History, Art of Historic Waco, will be open to the public at the East Terrace House December 5th through 16th. You can connect with the Historic Waco Foundation on Facebook and Instagram for more details. This conversation will be posted on kwbu.org. You can also visit creativewaco.org/blog for content related to this episode.
Voters in a New Jersey city have decided to support the arts, even though it will cost them. Here's David Smith with this week's edition of David and Art on KWBU.
In Jersey City, New Jersey, earlier this month, the election was not just about Biden versus Trump. Voters there had before them the question of a new tax that, if they approved it, they would soon be paying. And approve it they did, perhaps unlikely enough in today's climate. What's more is that the second largest city in New Jersey has now become that state's first to establish a municipal tax that will go to support the arts. Estimates are that it could generate between $1 and $2 million per year. A city arts committee will make decisions about where the money will go. The Jersey City mayor has worked for 2 years to get this referendum on the general election ballot. He didn't want to just stick a line for arts funding into the city budget. Doing that would make it too vulnerable to arbitrary cuts. When you get into tough times, the first thing that is cut is the arts, said Mayor Stephen Fulop. We wanted to create something that is secure no matter the financial state of the city. Earlier this year, the state legislature passed a new law that for the first time allows cities to create this kind of tax, up to 2 cents per $100 of value, to help their own arts scenes. The New Jersey Republican Party opposed the measure as nothing more than an excuse to raise your property tax, as if the money weren't going to be spent on a civic good. The tax rate itself would only amount to an extra $25 per year if you lived in a half a million dollar house. but it passed with the backing of 64% of voters. This should slam the door on anyone thinking the arts is an extra, a bonus, the first thing that should be cut, said Robinson Holloway, the former chair of the Jersey City Arts Council. He hopes that other municipalities will follow Jersey City's lead. Some officials doubted whether this was really the best time to go to the voters with a new tax, but, like in the entire country, arts organizations are being hurt badly by the ongoing pandemic and by prohibitions on gatherings the size of an audience for a symphony concert, a dance performance, or a play. Holloway said that waiting until 2021 would mean that a lot of the city's arts groups would simply go under. A year ago this month, voters in Charlotte, North Carolina, voted down a quarter-cent sales tax increase that would have gone to help that city's arts organizations, as well as its public parks. Such a defeat for the arts at the polls is inevitably cautionary. What can we take away from this? Well, I guess we can hope that other cities around the country might step up and prove that they're as cultured as Jersey City.
You can find this and past episodes of David and Art on our website at kwbu.org. Just look for David and Art in the Programs tab.
You're listening to Conversations with Creative Waco on KWBU, and I'm your host, Kennedy Sam. With me now is Melissa Pardon, co-owner of Maker's Edge Makerspace. Melissa, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So can you briefly share a little bit about yourself and your ties to Waco?
Sure. So my husband and I are junior high sweethearts and grew up in Missouri, but we came here to go to Baylor and just our first sort of, we came here 1 week after we got married. So we've been here now for 25 years and just love it, have made it our home and have decided to stay here.
Yeah. So what is a makerspace and how did Maker's Edge come to life?
Sure. So a makerspace is a collaborative workspace, which is a fancy way of saying, I always like to joke, it's like a gym membership for people who hate to exercise. So you pay for a membership to the space and you have complete access, unfettered access to the space and tools, mentors, and training. And you can come use the space for whatever activity or hobby or even small business that you have. You can utilize the tools in the space to make that happen for you.
Yeah. So did you guys come up with the idea of Maker's Edge or?
Well, I'd love to say we were that brilliant, but no. No, is the short answer. My husband and I started really out of our garage. He was a Boy Scout troop leader and noticed really this trend of kids who had no access to tools and equipment and mentorship with hands-on activities for doing Boy Scout activities. And I was doing Girl Scouts at the time and 4-H and FFA. That's just the life that we grew up in. And as we started working with kids and my husband advanced at L3 as an engineer and was starting to do hiring, he noticed, oh, that's kind of actually a common issue even among new graduates from college and community members, that old way of learning from grandparent to grandchild, that sort of passing down of knowledge, just isn't really available to most people. And there's a lot of barriers to that. And so we thought, well, how can we, because this is a passion of ours, how can we expand who we are offering this to? And at the same time, there was this great magazine called Make Magazine was coming out and was really started picking up speed. And they had this new creative idea of collaborative workspaces or what they called shared workspaces. And they would all kind of grow in together and do these nonprofit groups would start workspaces with tools that no one individual could afford, but they could all collaboratively afford it. We turn that into a for-profit model so that we could, one of the common complaints of makerspaces is you sort of have to fix the tool before you can use the tool because there's no real sort of coordinative direction over the space. And so we turned it into a for-profit where we manage the space, take care of the tools, have employees and mentors there, provide the training, and you just have to bring your passion and energy.
So with various sub-shops within the space, what industries and creative interests do you guys cater towards?
Well, we would like to say we think the more broad-minded you are in your education and your knowledge and your experience on tools, the better equipped you are to do the thing you love. Mm-hmm. So we actually have six clear, distinguished spaces. We have a wood shop, a metal shop, a weld room, an electronics area, which is our computer CADing area and programming area. Then we have our 3D center. So we have a 3D laser and 3D printers and CAD routers, that sort of thing. And we have a pottery and crafting area.
So you said, you know, this idea started from your garage. So as a husband who's an engineer and you guys both have backgrounds in, you know, Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, are you yourself a maker?
I am. I always say I'm an unusual maker. Uh-huh. I love to make things once.
Okay.
I love learning and I love going through the process of learning. Love it with a passion. I will do anything once. Once I've figured it out,
I move on
to the next thing of making. Now, my husband, though, being the engineer, totally opposite. We're opposite in many ways. But he will take that one thing and he will redo it over and over to streamline the process and learn how to do it better and mm-hmm. design it better and make it faster. And I check out. I'm bored at that point.
Right.
I'm like, tell me what else I can learn.
Right. Let's do welding next. Then yes, wood shop. Let's go welding.
Yes. And then there's some things I've decided I don't need to learn because I have an engineer who can do it for me.
That's smart. So being in a city like Waco that's home to various industries and then we have three higher education institutions and a home improvement empire, mm-hmm. why is a space like this needed and how does it elevate our creative and maker community?
So what we've discovered is that there needed to be a democratization of access. There are some people who still have those shops out of the home and who have the capacity to purchase tools and do these sort of creative things, but the access to them is really limited because of funds. And we were really concerned about It seems like that limiting factor means that there's a barrier of entry to people who want to give it a try or think it might be something they love, but they don't have the capacity to even take that first step. And that's why in our space, all of our education for our tools are free. It's part of your membership. Mm-hmm. In fact, we require it, especially for those 70-year-olds who think, I've been doing this all my life. Right. I know how to use a table saw. And I'm like, no, you don't.
Yeah, we don't need any
accidents. Yes. But I will say our insurance is great because mm-hmm. across the system, the nationwide, insurances for makerspaces are really, really small because the accidents in them are almost non-existent because of the education and the mentorship.
Yeah. So what kind of things are people making, you know, right now?
We're always rotating things that are being made in the space. We have the senior design team from Baylor right now is in the space, so they have several projects going on. They're doing an optical measuring device. I don't even get it, but anyway, uses beams and lasers and stuff. They're building a basic utility vehicle for third world countries. They're designing something that would go better for that. We have a couple artists from Creative Waco who actually use the space as their studio. We have some pottery artists. We're constantly having these sort of a turnover. It seems like this is what I love about a makerspace. It seems like when someone takes that first step and does something really cool, mm-hmm. then everybody in the space for the next few months does that. And then there seems to be sort of this slow crawl to a new thing.
Right.
Last year, it would have been the laser cutter. We were laser cutting and etching everything known to man. This year, the pottery is just on fire. We have pottery classes every Friday night. People can come in and do the tutorial. People who aren't members. So we have a lot of classes that are access to just the general public as well. And we're just getting this great turnover of just these different kind of projects in the space. And it's been beautiful to watch because I wouldn't have even thought some of these things. But our members are like, hey, can I do this?
Right.
And I'm sure, go for it.
So like you mentioned, Creative Waco has a membership with you guys. Mm-hmm. And so through that, Ali Menchaca and Wendy Davis Hogan get to, you know, do their art there. But also we get to, you know, participate in classes. So when you mentioned Pottery Night, I'm like, they literally changed my life with Pottery Night.
Well, good. I'm glad.
Yeah, because I've always been, like, super interested
and pottery, mm-hmm. And just like ceramics in general. And I always thought it was so cool how you could do that. And I did it at Hillcrest when I was there in elementary school and haven't done it since. Mm-hmm. And I got really bored over, you know, while we were in the stay in place and locked at home. And yes. I was like, man, I'm ready to like do some things and make some stuff.
Yes. We never closed at COVID.
Yeah.
We were blessed with the fact that we have a large space and we can social distance inside. Yeah. We did set up daily disinfecting things, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And we obviously all wear masks and stuff. So we do the normal protocol. But because of that, we've had a lot of new people walk in our doors because they are bored at home,
right.
But they don't want to stay home. And so they're like, well, maybe I ought to go check this space out. And so it's been really fun to see all of the new people who are interested in coming into the space because of that.
Yeah, I was definitely going to ask if you guys got a flurry of, you know, new DIYers.
We did. Yeah, we got a lot of interest because when I think parents getting rid of it, like, let's go check that space out.
Right. Yeah, so it has been a weird year for everyone. And you mm-hmm. said you guys were able to stay open mm-hmm. And, you know, just socially distanced. But have you guys been impacted in any other way or have had to make any adaptations to your business?
Yes, we like everybody else. I mean, we've had to, we've definitely changed how we clean tools. Tools are a particular thing. They need to be sanitized in a certain way or they rust or deteriorate, things like that. So we've had to really think about that. We've also had to social distance, but that's actually we already are because tools you can't use in close location to other people. So it was sort of a natural process. Mm-hmm. I think the real change has been how do we, because we're a huge education center, so how do we make sure we maintain safety and also continue to facilitate these classes? That's why we've actually focused in the last few months of moving our trainings to partially online. So you take a video tutorial and then you come in and you test off or pass off on the tool. That has been really helpful to get more people in the space at different times instead of having everyone come to one class.
Yeah, so with holiday season approaching for anyone mm-hmm. who has a loved one with, you know, a creative itch or a making itch, how can they become, you know, members with you guys?
Yeah, we actually always run a Christmas special. We'll make something for you to stick under the tree so you have something physical in hand to give. But it's, you know, you buy 1 month and you get like 3 months of access for your loved one. There's always that person out there where you're like, I'm tired of giving them a physical thing. I would love to give them an experience, and especially an experience that then can journey into developing new relationships and friendships. And so that's what Maker's Edge is perfect for. We also are starting a new gift certificate this year for geared towards just youth. We want to give them, we realize there's a lot of kids at home doing sort of that online learning thing, giving them a chance to go into the space, obviously in a secure environment, but to have a chance to journey around the shops on the different tools. And we're taking 5 months, spring semester, to do that. You can find out all of that. You should just follow us online.
Yeah.
All of that is accessed through our social media. The Facebook is really where we market most because that's where a lot of parents are. But if you go to our website, all of that stuff you can purchase online. But like I said, if you come by the space, we'll give you a cute little thing in hand so that you can put it under the tree.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Connect with Maker's Edge online through their website, Facebook, and Instagram for updates and upcoming workshops. This conversation will be posted on kwbu.org. You can also visit creativewaco.org/blog for content related to this episode. Can you believe this is our last episode of the year? We are looking forward to returning to your airwaves in 2021 for more deep dives into local arts and culture. We wish you a happy holiday season. This has been Conversations with Creative Waco on KWBU, and I'm your host, Kennedy Sam. Thanks for tuning in.